Sadvaitam, Sadvaduktam, Parijanasaitam, Krishna Chaitanya Deva. Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vidam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Today's the 18th, right? Yeah. March 18th, 2009 in Auckland, and we're reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12. And going through text 1 through 12. So each time I do this a little bit differently. Okay, why don't we first read the verses together? Does everyone have a Bhagavad Gita? Okay. Page 541 in this book. Arjuna inquired, everyone together, which are considered to be more perfect, those who are always properly engaged in your devotional service, or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested? The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, everybody, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshiping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect. But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed, and immovable, the impersonal conception of the absolute truth, by controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons engaged in the welfare of all at last achieve me. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, and being devoted to me without deviation, engage in devotional service and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pritha, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always, without a doubt. My dear Arjuna, O winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, then follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. In this way, develop a desire to attain me. If you cannot practice the regulations of bhakti yoga, then just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage. If, however, you are unable to work in this consciousness of me, then try to act giving up all results of your work and try to be self-situated. If you cannot take to this practice, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge. Better than knowledge, however, is meditation, and better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action, for by such renunciation one can attain peace of mind. How do I make it louder? I knew there was something.
Chapter 12, Devotional Service.
Everything's all that.
O Krishna, I realize that I am more attached to your two-armed form. I now want to confirm that the path of bhakti is the best path. Therefore, who are considered better? Those who worship the impersonal Brahman, or devotees who worship you? My dear Arjuna, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always worshipping me with great faith are the most perfect. These devotees are the best because bhakti is the quickest process for attaining me. But those who worship the all-pervading, impersonal conception of the absolute truth by controlling the senses and being equal to everyone Such persons, engaged in the welfare of all, at last achieve me. Why are they inferior, Krishna, if they will also achieve you? Because those who are attached to my impersonal feature have to experience more difficulty, Arjuna. It also takes them a longer time to obtain their goal. However, whatever one may obtain by karma and jnana is easily and quickly obtained by my devotees. My unalloyed bhaktas do not even think of crossing this material world. Therefore, I personally uplift them without their desiring it. They make no endeavor to elevate themselves other than devotional service to my lotus feet. Those unalloyed devotees renounce all activities that are obstacles to my devotion. They only hear about and remember me and engage in pure devotional service. In this mood, they meditate on my pastimes, their minds fully engaged in me. I quickly uplift such devotees from the ocean of birth and death, for I cannot tolerate delay. I come on Garuda and personally pick them up and take them away. Other yogis take the path of light or darkness, but I do not care for this process for my pure devotees. Bhakti does not depend on prescribed duties or anything else. Devotees attain me by nothing more than devotion and chanting. Then why should I fight, Krishna? Because your fighting is devotional service, Arjuna. How many times must I tell you? Just fix your mind upon me and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always without a doubt. Not like the Mishra Bhaktas who gradually come to me. They only see my Aishwarya feature. Krishna, it's difficult to fix the mind and intelligence on you. What will be the result if I cannot do it? If you are not able to directly remember me without deviation, Arjuna, then bring your mind back again and again. Fix it on my form. Practicing like this is called Abhyas Yoga or Sadhana Bhakti. The mind is like a river which flows to filthy areas, but control it with dams. Bring it to the ocean of my form and swim in this ocean of rasa. You are called Dhananjaya because you fought with enemies and obtained wealth. Now, fight with the enemy of your mind and obtain the wealth of meditation. My mind flickers like the wind, Krishna. I don't have the strength to control it. What should I do? If you cannot perform Abhyas Yoga, Arjuna, and your mind is influenced by ignorance, then you need to work for me. What type of work, Krishna? Build temples, Arjuna. Make gardens. Clean my temple. Hear and chant. Pick flowers or perform puja. All these services are directly related with devotion. By performing these activities for my sake, your mind will become attached to my form and glories. Even if you cannot remember me while working, you will still attain prema. However, if you think you are a famous aristocrat and you cannot perform menial service for me, then you can perform yoga and renounce the fruits of whatever activities you perform and give them to me. Still, if you cannot do this, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge. Better than knowledge, however, is meditation. And better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action, because that will bring peace of mind. Krishna, what...
So what happened in the last chapter? I know we had a week break, and you might have forgotten. I don't know how to... I don't know where the little thing is to... Turn this off. Okay. What happened in the last chapter?
His universal form,
yes. And Prabhupada talked a lot there about how some people might think that the universal form is greater. So therefore Arjuna is asking this question, even though Krishna has said so many times, just think of me, just worship me. So now Arjuna is asking, okay, what's better, to think of you in some impersonal way or some personal way? So we have what's going on in this chapter.
better. Impersonalism. More personalism. And Krishna says, personalism, he said, this works, but slowly. And it's difficult. And Prabhupada also says in the purport, it may not work. And here Krishna says, it's easy and natural. And then he says, how to do it. So, first of all, about pure devotion. Practice devotion. Which is a funny term. And working for him. And then he says, if you can't do that, these are other things you can do which will help you. And you can give up results of your work. Meditate and cultivate knowledge. Which is karma, yoga, and jnana. So that's the structure of this part of the chapter. And from texts, eight to 12. These are some of the most important verses anywhere as far as how we live in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and how we should preach to people. And these ones, 8 to 10, basically describe the activities of the core members, the main members of the Hare Krishna movement. But if you're trying to help people advance, that's... Could someone move that curtain just a little bit? I'm going to... Thank you. If you're at all trying to engage people in Krishna's service and trying to help people to come gradually to the state of yoga and spiritual life, these verses 8 through 12 are very important. They're really the whole map of how to do it. Everything is there. We should also note that this chapter 12 is the last chapter of the middle six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, and it really ends the section that's focused on Bhakti Yoga. The last part of this chapter, which we'll do tomorrow, not tomorrow, next week, is looking at the qualities of a devotee. If someone does all these things, what are their symptoms? So that we'll do next week. Okay, the first thing we're going to look at is personalism versus impersonalism. And although Krishna does say immediately that thinking of his personal form is more perfect, he does say in text 3 to 4 that impersonalists will eventually come to him. Now, in order to do that, they have to fulfill several requirements. They have to control their senses. They have to be equal to all living entities and engage in the welfare of all. Now, I would guess, and I haven't done any kind of study, but I would guess that the vast majority of people today who claim to be following some impersonal path do not meet these criteria. At least most people I've met, and in research we call that anecdotal evidence. It's not some kind of firm scientific study, but at least most people I met who claim to be impersonalists do not control their senses and are not engaged in welfare work for all living entities. Many of them are even meat eaters. Many of them are taking intoxicants and so forth. But a real impersonalist, you know, you don't meet many of them, but a real impersonalist who's doing these things, Krishna says at last they will come to him. But Prabhupada says that often there's much penance involved. He says one has to cease the sensual activities of seeing, hearing, tasting, working, etc. This means somebody who is doing practically nothing. They're withdrawing their senses from the world. When I was working on some curriculum materials in London, we were looking at devotee festivals, and then in the UK, children are required to study all the religions that exist within the UK. So we also had to include some festivals from different faiths. And we decided to include one from the Jains on the appearance of Mahavir. Mahavir is the person who really brought Jainism to the fore in modern times. He's not the originator of the Jain conception. What he did is he wandered around naked, not talking to anybody, not practically interacting with the world at all. There was one time when he, two or three times maybe, when he became severely injured. Either someone injured him or by accident, I don't remember the details. And he made no attempt to do anything about it. I think there was something that went through his eye, and he just left it there. Now, not to take any action. No action. No action to seek pleasure, no action to alleviate pain, nothing. No, as practically no interaction with the world. People talk about leaving a small ecological footprint. Well, someone like that was trying to leave an almost invisible ecological footprint, taking practically nothing. The really adept persons like that don't even eat. You know, we read about some of these yogis that live on sunlight and air. Some of them hardly even breathe. Now, first of all, that's not exactly a program that most people can follow. That's the first thing. Second of all, it's not very attractive. Now, after 13 years of such practice, he has said, I don't know if he did or not, but his followers claim that after 13 years of such practice, he became Brahman realized. So, a lot of difficulty. And then, the very important verse is verse 5. Klesho dika tarashtesham avyakta shaktatejasam avyakta hi gadir dukham dehavadvir vakute. Krishna says here it's very troublesome. This is a very troublesome process. And this purport is extremely important. Prabhupada's making two points. It's hard to do it. It's hard to achieve perfection in that way. You have to do these, some of these things that Prabhupada says here. He says you have to understand the non-perceptual feelings. I don't know what that is. He says they have to understand the unmanifested representation of the Supreme through such Vedic literatures, the Upanishads. They have to learn the language, understand the non-perceptual feelings, and realize all these processes. This is not easy for a common man. I'd say it's not easy for almost anybody. It's not even easy for uncommon people. I mean, there are people who have, you know, spontaneous kundalini awakenings and see the Brahmajyoti now and then. I've met some of these people. But even them, even for those people for whom it's just natural, you know, they wake up one day and their kundalini wakes up and shoots up to their head. Have you ever met people like that? No? I met a few people like that. Even for those people, to really practice the disciplines of impersonal yoga is very, 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 very difficult. And often what happens is their awakened kundalini just gives them physical and sometimes mental problems. There's a very famous book. Anyway, I'm not going to tell you the author. Anyway, there's a very famous book about someone who had this sort of spontaneous kundalini awakening and really tried to control it and ended up having mental problems and all sorts of physical health problems. And one devotee I know to whom this happened, you know, just spontaneously kundalini woke up and he found himself floating in the Brahmajyoti. He said, "It's for most people, it's like giving a chainsaw to a three-year-old, and it simply creates havoc. So the process is very difficult, very painful. You probably won't make it. Really, even most people today, you know, can go to the Brahmajyoti. They can't stay there. And they can't give up their materialistic activities. Their heart doesn't get cleaned of material desires. One of these people sent me a video from one of these folks, and he said, people think that just because I've seen the Brahmajyoti, I'm a saint and I have no material desires. He says, that's not true at all. I'm still struggling. It's extremely difficult. So the practice is very, very difficult. You have to spend 6 or 8 hours a day in deep meditation, away from everybody, not interacting with anybody. You have a risk, literally, of going insane. You have a risk of damaging your body. And when you achieve it, you haven't even become free of all your material desires. Great. And so it's a very difficult process. And then Prabhupada also says here that if you achieve full perfection in it, if you really make all your desires nil, which means they're really just being sort of repressed, they're not purified. But if you're able to perfectly do that, he says, then when you're introduced to Krishna, you can't give up the idea. You can't give up your impersonalism. And I may have used this example with you people before, but I use this example a lot of my nephew, who went to a Jewish brahmacharya ashram, where they have a guru called a Rebbe, and they don't have anything to do with women. You live a very austere life. So at one point, he went to his Rebbe and said, I think I want to get married. Actually, in Judaism, they don't have any sannyasis. They don't have any nastiki brahmacharis. Pretty much everyone is assumed to get married. And his Rebbe said to him, all right, well, for so many years, you haven't had anything to do with women other than your mother and your sister. You haven't looked at any women. You haven't talked to any women. Said, so if I find a nice girl for you, you have to look at her. You have to talk to her. Sometimes we even find this problem in the Hare Krishna movement. You know, somebody's been a brahmachari for 10 years, and then they decide they want to get married, and when they meet the girl, they say, well, I want to get married, but I sort of still kind of want to stay a brahmachari. Now, one devotee who was talking to me about getting married was telling me, yeah, you know, I want to find a nice girl, but I want to find a girl who's not going to change my life too much. He's a temple president, and he's a real scholar, and he gets up at 2 every morning to chant his rounds, and he says, I want a girl who's not going to, you know, want a house and this and that, and I'm like, good luck. So this is the problem with the impersonalists. The impersonalists, they become so attached to no relationships and no form and no feelings that when it gets time to have that with Krishna, they resist it. And the one devotee I've spoken to who was naturally adept in impersonalism, just obviously from previous lives, told me that this is a real struggle for him, that he thinks desires are all evil. And therefore, when it comes to having devotional desires, he resists it. And it's very difficult for him to progress in Krishna consciousness because he's so attached to this impersonal conception. So it's very dangerous. And Prabhupada says here in this purport, makes a very strong statement. And he says, thus the process of centering attention on the unmanifested, the inconceivable, which is beyond the approach of the senses, as already expressed in this verse, should never be encouraged at any time, especially in this age. It is not advised by Lord Krishna. Now, first Prabhupada says never at any time, and then he says especially in this age. So obviously, there's some scope for encouraging it in other ages. But what's very interesting, and I know I've made this point over and over again, turn to the end of the chapter, and in the very last purport, Prabhupada says, the impersonal conception of the Supreme Absolute Truth, as described in this chapter, is recommended only up to the time one surrenders himself for self-realization. In other words, as long as one does not have the chance to associate with a pure devotee, the impersonal conception may be beneficial. So this is very common that you'll find in one purport Prabhupada saying it should never be encouraged at any time. And then, a few purports later, he'll say that it may be beneficial in some situations. So we really have to be careful of taking one quote from one particular place and forming a whole philosophy around it. Now, if there's something that Shastra and Guru and Sadhus consistently say the same thing everywhere, then you can take it that that's an absolute statement. But when you find that Shastra and Sadhu and Gurus are saying different things in different places, then it's necessary to understand everything in context. Even Krishna himself is saying that impersonalism will eventually lead to him, but please don't do it. It's much more difficult. I don't recommend it. So we can't say that, well, it has no use for anybody ever. When Prabhupada's saying here it should not be encouraged at any time, and later on he said it's useful until you meet a pure devotee. Well, as soon as we're meeting somebody, folks, as soon as we're contacting anybody, guess what? They're meeting a pure devotee. You can say, well, I'm not a pure devotee. Well, first of all, we're all pure devotees in an immature stage, at least. Prabhupada said, all of my disciples are pure devotees. That doesn't mean that every one of his disciples are functioning at the level of prema at that particular time. But just like a green little peach is still a peach. In other words, we're on the path of pure devotion. And also we're representing pure devotees, right? And when they meet us, they're meeting the pure devotees through us. So therefore, we have no need to encourage impersonalism in anybody. The only people who we should encourage to be impersonalists are people we haven't met yet. Okay? And we can discuss this later next week, but basically, Prabhupada does go on in that purport explaining what is the possible benefit of impersonalism for people who haven't yet contacted a personalistic conception, that it may have some benefits for some people. However, here in 12.5, Prabhupada's making the point, very much in accord with this verse here, that the problem with impersonalism is if you've cultivated it, when you meet a pure devotee, you may not be able to accept personalism. You may be too attached to your impersonalistic conception. No, no, I can't look at the girl I'm going to marry. Women are evil. You know, so that's the difficulty. All right, now Krishna, after describing how difficult impersonalism is, he describes how easy Krishna consciousness is. And I never understand how I can like find something when I'm studying it and in my notes, and then when I come here, it disappears. Frustrating. Well, hopefully I'll find it again by next week. Oh, we should just mention briefly that also in 12.5 Prabhupada talks about deity worship and the benefit of worshiping the deity. Okay, anyway, I can't find it. So in 6 and 7, Krishna is saying that the easy thing about devotional service is that I deliver the devotee, Krishna is saying. And this is one of the main differences between bhakti yoga and jnana yoga and gyan yoga and impersonalism, is that in all those paths, you're doing it. Of course, even then, Krishna is certainly helping you. You can't even breathe without Krishna helping you. But you're really going on the force of your own determination. In mystic yoga, you're clearing out your anarthas. You know, you're raising the kundalini to the different chakras, and as you're doing so, you have to clean out all the channels and all the nadis, and you have to free yourself of all your material anarthas. But we don't make a separate attempt to free ourselves of anarthas. We serve Krishna, and automatically our anarthas are gone. Automatically doesn't mean that we don't do anything. I think of it like, if you're a vegetarian, it doesn't mean that you go to the supermarket and anything you pull off the shelf is automatically vegetarian. You still have to read the labels. You have to make some effort to be a vegetarian. So it's not exactly automatic in the sense that you just chant Hare Krishna and all of a sudden you wake up and say, oh, you know, all of my anarthas are gone. But it's an automatic part of the process. You don't have to do it as something separate. You know, like Prabhupada says, you're automatically a vegetarian if you're a devotee. But again, automatically a vegetarian still means you have to make some effort to make sure you're eating vegetarian food. It's not going to say how long ago it was. But anyway, some devotee gave me some prasadam one day, and after eating it, I realized it had garlic in it. And they must have used something from a shop that had garlic. So it's not, you know, just because I'm a devotee automatically means I don't have to think. Okay, but the point is that Krishna takes care of you. He says he does it without delay. Swift deliverer. You don't have to wait, you know, millions and millions and millions of lifetimes and hundreds of thousands of years. And he takes care of you. You're always thinking of him and he'll always think of you. He's personally engineering the process. Again, I wish I could find that section. Well, Prabhupada says here that he comes on his bird carrier Garuda. You don't have to be an expert swimmer. So we don't have to be sad, you know, if we can't open up all of our chakras and wake up our kundalini and all those sort of things that people probably ask you about since you run a yoga center. So you don't have to lament that, oh, I don't know how to do all that stuff. Oh. Krishna will take care of us. I was just reading in Wellington about Dhruva Maharaj, who did perform, of course, mystic yoga as part of his bhakti yoga. But when he saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Lord just woke him up. It's explained like he came out of a sleeping condition. All of his senses and his mind were immediately awakened. Krishna opens the prison door at a certain point. All right, now how do you do this? How do you do this very simple process? So if we look at text 8, we find Mayi is here three times. Mayeva, Mayi Buddhim, Mayeva again. Just think about me. And Prabhupada's saying here that if someone does this, he lives in Krishna. The devotee becomes Krishna-eyes by eating these remnants. Now this verse is talking about someone who's already attached to Krishna in love. Someone who's at least on the platform of Ruchi or Shakti. And we see how easy this is because Prabhupada says, and I know I make this point a lot, that all of us already have a Shakti to something or someone. There's already something or someone or some activity that naturally pulls our mind over and over and over again. That our mind and heart naturally go there. If you're in love with somebody in this world, now I have this wonderful boy I'm in love with, naturally you're going to think of him. Right? And if you have ever been in love with a boy, you naturally think about him. You naturally think, what's he doing? Where is he now? When will he call me? Every time the phone rings, oh, is that him? Right? And if he doesn't call you for a day, you think, oh, why didn't he call me? Doesn't he love me anymore? Is he going to see me anymore? Naturally, it doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, you're driving your car, you're cooking, you're thinking about him. Nobody has to say to you, now think about John today. It just happens. In fact, you can hardly stop yourself from thinking about him. And the same will happen when you have a child. You'll naturally think about that child. It's just natural. You know, a pregnant woman, she's always thinking about her baby. What should I eat? Can I eat this thing? Can I do this thing? Will this thing be bad for my baby? Will this thing be good for my baby? What kind of music should I play? Just natural. When the child's born, you're thinking, oh, are they breathing? Are they okay? How are they doing? Do I have the right clothes? Do I have enough diapers? It's just natural. When you love somebody, you think about them. Or if you're really attached to, you know, getting your degree, then you'll always be thinking about that. What book do I have to study for my course? What time does my course start? Do I have all my homework together? And other people are talking to you about other things, and you're thinking about the paper you have to write and the course you have to go to. So ultimately, bhakti yoga means thinking of Krishna like that. Exactly like that. That no matter what we're doing, no matter where we are, we're always living in Krishna. What would Krishna like? What would Krishna like? What kind of ankle bells is Krishna wearing? What pastime is Krishna doing right now? Now, those on the stage, they meditate on the Astakalya Lila, what Krishna is doing at different times of the day, how Krishna is milking the cows, how Krishna is going to the pasturing grounds, how he's playing with the cowherd boys, how he goes to Radhakund with the gopis, how he plays with the cowherd boys, how he comes back in the afternoon, and how Mother Yasoda is feeding him, how he's going to bed at night. So exactly like materially, you know, if you have a relative, like I have relatives in distant places, which probably many of you do also, and sometimes you may be thinking, oh, what are they doing right now? And you look at your watch and you say, oh, where they are, it's such and such time. You know, here it's 8 in the morning. Oh, there it's 2 in the afternoon. Oh, what are they doing right now? Oh, maybe they're eating lunch. So that's actually bhakti yoga. One is thinking, oh, it's 8:15 now. What is Krishna doing? Maybe he's eating his breakfast with Madhu Mangal. Or one is thinking of different pastimes of Krishna. How Krishna killed the Keshi demon and stuck his left hand in the mouth of the Keshi demon. Or how he's talking with Arjuna on the battlefield. And Prabhupada said, chanting Hare Krishna means you automatically think of Krishna. You, as soon as you say Krishna, you think of Krishna talking to Arjuna in the battlefield. Or you think of Krishna dancing with the gopis. Or you think of Krishna giving the butter to the monkeys. Again, exactly the same way if there's someone that you really love. And I say, oh, you remember Sally Smith. And immediately you think, oh, yeah, Sally Smith. We used to go swimming together, and we used to go hiking together. And, oh, I remember that time we did this. So that's the point we come to in bhakti yoga. And you may say, well, oh, boy, I can't do that. I hardly ever do that. When I'm chanting Hare Krishna, I don't immediately automatically think of Krishna speaking the Bhagavad Gita and Krishna sticking his hand in the mouth of the Keshi demon and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu dancing at Rath Yatra. Those things don't come spontaneously to my mind. I don't immediately think of the form of the deity. In fact, I can go a day or a week or a month or a year without ever thinking about Krishna's ankle bells. You know, I've got to kind of sit down and go, okay, what am I supposed to think about Krishna right now? So if that's the process, well, I don't think I can do that. So then Krishna says in the next verse, he says, you can do abhyas yoga. These two lines are very, very important. Abhyas yoga tato mam ichaptam dananjaya. Dananjaya, you conquered wealth, so you can also conquer your mind. And the purpose of this abhyas yoga, abhyas means practice. Krishna used this word also in the 6th chapter. It's a similar context where Arjuna said, Chanchala Himana Krishna, my mind is always wandering, and Krishna says, by constant practice and by detachment. The same word, abhyas, by practice. By practice, you'll get an ichcha, you'll get a desire. Before there can be union, there must be desire. You can't have union without desire. So first there has to be desire. The reason that I naturally think about some boy I'm in love with or my baby or my coursework at the university is I have some desire. Right? There's some desire in me for attachment. And the reason, my dear friends, that we find it so hard to think of Krishna's ankle bells and Krishna putting his hand in Keshi's mouth and Krishna picking up the chariot wheel to run after Bhishma Dev, and that these things don't just come spontaneously into our mind all the time, is that we don't have the desire. We have other desires. We have desires. We have the wrong desires. So how to cultivate that desires is by abhyas yoga. And yoga means union. You have practice union. Union is love. How do you practice love? You practice love? Does that make any sense? Love is a feeling, it's a desire, it's a craving. How can you practice that? So that is sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti is you're practicing love. And how do you do that? We're going to be studying the next few Sundays the Nectar of Instruction. And in text 3, Rupa Goswami explains, what are the ways you practice? You follow in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. You follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. Regulative principles are used in different senses. We talk about the 4 regulative principles, but generally when Srila Prabhupada says practice the regulative principles, he means things such as getting up early, worshiping the deity, chanting a prescribed number of rounds, reading the shastras, cooking for Krishna, all these things. He's talking about that as our regulative principles. And following in the footsteps of the previous acharya. Okay, so here's somebody who loves Krishna. They're always absorbed in Krishna. They're naturally thinking of Krishna. And I see, what do they do? In psychology, they call this modeling. So I don't know if you know, but for 2 years I had intensive study in psychology and counseling and therapy. And one of the basic premises of the courses that I was taking was that people have within them what they need to accomplish their goals. You just have to find a way of accessing it. That whatever you want to accomplish, it's within you, generally. But sometimes it may not be. And then you find someone else who has it and you model. So really, we really do have everything we need to achieve bhakti. That's our natural state. But because we've forgotten it, we can see someone else who has it and model. Now, we don't imitate, but we follow their example. All right, here's someone who loves Krishna. What do? Oh, they say Krishna's name. Even in this world, if you love somebody, you say their name. You'll be talking about them. You'll sing songs about them. Aren't there a lot of love songs where they just focus on someone's name? Right? Oh, Gloria, Gloria. Oh, Paul, oh, Paula. That was a famous song when I was a little girl. Oh, Paul, oh, Paula. That's what people do when they're in love. And that's what great saintly persons also do. What else do they do? They read about the activities of the person they love. Again, even materially people do that. If someone's in love with, you know, a movie star or a sports hero, they like to talk about them. What did they do? What did this actress do? What did this soccer player do? What did this golf player do? When they have people are writing newspaper articles, right, magazine articles, and people are reading them and talking about them. People come to the workplace and they're saying, hey, did you see how so-and-so kicked the ball last night in the football field? And wasn't that cool? Oh, yeah, it was amazing. I read one article once about a tennis player called Federer. It said, Federer as religious experience. And it was describing how he plays tennis. And they said, the way he plays tennis, it's almost as if he surpassed the limits of having a human body. How does he stay in the air that long? How does he keep the ball there that long? You know, what are his wonderful activities? What are his mystic activities? So that's what the great transcendentalists do about Krishna. They're meditating on that. How did he kill this big elephant, Kuvalayapita? How does he dance simultaneously with 16,108 girls? How does he find butter when it's hidden in the darkness? How does he do all these wonderful activities? Satam prasango mamavirya samvido bhavanti ritkarna rasayanam katha tadyoshi tajvat apavaragavardhmani shraddha ratir bhakti anukramishyati. By hearing about Krishna's heroic activities in the association of devotees, it enters into the ear, it goes into the heart. It's like a rasayana, for those of you familiar with Ayurveda. Rasa means also taste. And when you digest food, you want it to turn mostly into rasa, not into what's called ama. Ama is toxins that pollute your system. You want it to go right into energy. So certain foods are called rasayanas, in that they just turn into rasa immediately. And that's particularly locally grown tree-ripened fruit is a rasayana, for example. Your body just digests it and assimilates it. So this hearing about Krishna is a rasayana, which brings you from shraddha to rati to bhakti, which brings you from faith to ecstasy to love. So we imitate their activities, or follow their activities would be a more appropriate word. We see, what are they doing? They're doing things for Krishna. They're preaching Krishna consciousness. Generally speaking, there are some saintly persons who don't preach, but generally speaking, the saintly persons, why are they preaching, by the way? You ever find something wonderful that's really exciting and you want to send it to somebody? This is the principle now on the internet of what they call viral marketing. Somebody will make a video on YouTube and people will see it and they'll think, oh, this is really funny or interesting. And what will they do? They'll share it. They'll email the link to all their friends. I'm sure some of us, I'm sure all of us have at least one annoying person in our life who's, you know, every 3 days sending us a link to something. Why? Because they find it exciting. And sometimes I'm sure we're all tempted like that. You read something, you see something like, oh, I want to share it. And you think, I don't know if I want to be one of those annoying people. And everyone just deletes their email from their inbox. But that's why the great devotees are preaching. They're not preaching because it's a rule. And because their guru said, go out and preach. Like, oh, I got to go preach. It's like, wow, this is so exciting. I'm overwhelmed with joy. I got to tell everybody about it. Somehow I've got to share it with people. Sort of like you go to some country where everybody's starving and they're serving, you know, a healthy meal half a kilometer away and you want to go to everybody. Hey, you know, there's some food right over there. Come on. Right? So that's why they're preaching. But we again follow in their footsteps. Okay, they're saying Krishna's name. They're meditating on Krishna's form. They're serving Krishna's form as a deity. All the Goswamis had their own deities they're worshiping. They're preaching Krishna consciousness. They're reading the scriptures. They're talking about Krishna, as we read in the 10th chapter, Madhgata, Madhgata Pranam, Bodhayantas Parasparam, Katayantas Chamam Nityam, Tushanti Charamanti Chara, getting great satisfaction from that. So we practice like that. Now, this practice yoga applies especially to what's going on with our mind. This verse here, text 9, this is particularly, we're practicing yoga. We're practicing having this idea of having union, loving union with Krishna. That means it's something we're doing with our mind. So this is very related to Krishna's similar verse in the 6th chapter. You can control your mind by constant practice and by detachment. Now you might say, well, you know, I really find it hard to even do that. I really find it hard even when I'm chanting Hare Krishna to think about the name, to think about Krishna's form. Prabhupada said, you chant Hare Krishna, immediately you think of the form of the deity. You know, I may not even be able to do that. All right, then work for me. You can't do that, then work for me. At least use your body for me. Because what we do with our body eventually we'll probably start thinking about. That's the idea. When Krishna says here, you'll come to the perfect stage. Come to the perfect stage. Please, this is a very important point. Come to the perfect stage means you will come to the stage of always thinking about Krishna. It doesn't mean that you'll be working for Krishna like a robot and, you know, you go back to Godhead like that. No, it means it will bring you to that stage. It will bring you to the stage where you're actually doing Abhyas Yoga, where you're starting to practice bringing your mind to Krishna, which will bring you to the stage where you're spontaneously thinking of Krishna. So this verse applies in two ways. These two verses, 9 and 10, apply in two ways. It applies to the person who's in sadhana bhakti, who's even maybe taken vows already of initiation, but they're really having trouble engaging their mind in Krishna's service. So at least they're engaging their body. They're going through the activities of bhakti yoga externally. And most of us start like that. Most of us, no matter how great and advanced we think we are in the beginning, we're really just starting on the platform of the body. And our mind is somewhere else. Even when we think it's not, it probably is. So most of us start like that. And that is okay. In fact, Krishna is saying, if that's all you can do, that's all you can do. But you don't want to stay there. You want to understand what the goal is. That's why I'm saying it's so important. Understand the goal is not just that I'm working for Krishna with my body and not with my mind and heart. That's not the goal. You don't want to stay on that platform. In fact, staying on that platform is very, very difficult. Because to have a disconnect between your body and mind won't last for a long time. It just won't. either your body will follow your mind or your mind will follow your body. You cannot maintain it for a long period of time without some heavy-duty repression and heart hardening. So if you, Prabhupada was asked, is it faster to make advancement living in an ashram? Prabhupada said, that depends on whether or not your mind is on a different subject matter. So obviously it's easier to make advancement when you're associating with other people who also want to be Krishna conscious, but if you're always thinking about something else, you don't get that much of the benefit. Like if I go to university and I'm sitting in the class and I'm thinking about the football game or I'm thinking about my boyfriend, you know, I'm not going to learn very much from the professor just because I'm there with my body. So anyway, it does apply to that. It applies to the beginner in sadhana bhakti. If you can't keep bringing your mind to me, well, then at least do some work for me. And it also applies in another sense. These two verses also apply to people who are not doing what we call sadhana bhakti at all. People who just come to the temple and do some work for Krishna. They're not chanting 16 rounds, they're not rising early, they're not reading the scriptures, but they're doing some work for Krishna. And of course, Prabhupada talks about that in the third chapter, text 31. He said, if you accept the instructions of Krishna, but you can't follow them, at least do some work for Krishna. And he says that work should be with love. There should be some affection there. As we'll be discussing this Sunday with Nectar of Instruction, that our attitude is very important. You know, at least love for somebody, love for the guru, love for even some other devotee in the temple, love for somebody. Some feeling of affection that I really want to help, I really care. So our Krishna consciousness movement is basically made up of people who are following text 8, text 9, and text 10. So we have people in our Hare Krishna movement who are always absorbed in love for Krishna. Somewhere between the stages of, you know, ruchi and prema. Then we have people who are engaged in abhyas yoga, who are really working at bringing their mind to Krishna's lotus feet, who are constantly endeavoring, let me study the philosophy, let me chant, let me preach, let me somehow or other always think of Krishna. And then there are people who are working for Krishna, which is either the very beginners who are just doing service with their body without really understanding what they're doing, and also people who are not engaged in sadhana bhakti, but who are doing some service for the society. So those are the three main categories of people who we would say are members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. All right. Now, Krishna is very kind, and I'd like to point out this very important difference between Vedic religion, if we can call it that, and most other religions on the planet today. Most religions on the planet today teach you're in or you're out. You believe in Jesus or you don't. You accept Muhammad or you don't. And you're getting saved or you're not. And it's one life and you make it or not. And of course, by having those sort of black and white distinctions, they do several things. First of all, they make it very difficult for certain people to take up their process at all. Secondly, they either have to say that a lot of not very good people are going to heaven or a lot of not very bad people are going to hell. You know, because they're making this black and white distinction. So the Vedic scriptures do not teach that kind of a philosophy. In fact, if you look at the Vedic literatures as a whole, they're giving different systems of religion for people in different modes. They're saying you're in the mode of ignorance, fine, kill a goat once a month and offer it to Kali. You can worship this demigod. You can do. There's a lot of different religious processes given in the Vedic scriptures for different people. Therefore, the Vedic religion can serve the whole society. You don't have to be in or out. Everybody can be in. There's some place for everybody. And we understand that we're eternal. There's many, many lifetimes. And you can go through a different process, what's appropriate for you, as long as you're going up, somehow or other, going up. Maybe slowly, maybe a winding road, but somehow or other going up. At the present time in Kali Yuga, it's very difficult to get people to gradually go up because the society in general doesn't support that. The society in general is pushing so hard towards degradation. So we, as the Hare Krishna movement, we don't really teach all these other parts of Vedic philosophy, nor do we encourage them. We we teach them in a general way, but we're not teaching them to the public because we don't think that it's very possible for people to really engage in them. At the same time, Krishna is saying here, if someone says, I can't even work for Krishna, I can't even give my money to the Hare Krishna movement. If I send a check to the movement, then my wife will divorce me. Have you met people like this? I have. You know, or I'm already part of another religious movement. I'm already a minister in a church. We have some devotees who are acting as ministers and priests and monks and Christian organizations. But it must be pretty hard. How long are you going to go on, you know, being a Presbyterian minister and chanting 16 rounds on the quiet and off in your room? It's a little difficult. And so there are people who feel that because Prabhupada says, or because of family, this and that, you know, because of social, familiar, or religious considerations, or some other impediments. One of the biggest questions people ask everywhere in the world when they first start taking up Krishna consciousness is, what do I do about the fact that some of my family members and friends are opposing me? And when I hear that question, I think, well, we all went through that. But for some people, they're not willing to give that up. They're not willing to do something that goes against that social milieu. So Krishna's saying, all right, give in charity. Give in charity. You can't even work for me? Work for somebody. Do something selfless. Get in this mood that my possessions are not mine. They're to be used for higher benefit. So Krishna there is recommending karma, good karma. And then he also says, by the way, text 12 refers to text 10, not text 11. If you cannot take to this practice means Abhyas Yoga or working for me. So Krishna is giving three recommendations. Either do good works or engage in meditation or cultivate knowledge. Cultivate knowledge does not mean study physics. It's not what he means, although there's no prohibition against studying physics. But that's not what Krishna means here. What Krishna means here is cultivate knowledge of reality. See that this world is an illusion, that it's false, that it's temporary, that there's no real happiness here. Take to one of those paths. And it's we'll note it's interesting in the purport of text 11, where Prabhupada says here, that when one who is not even interested in the activities of Krishna consciousness gives charity to some hospital or some other social institution, he gives up the hard-earned results of his activities. And Prabhupada says here, that is also recommended here, because by the practice of giving up the fruits of one's activities, one is sure to purify his mind gradually, and in that purified stage of mind, one becomes able to understand Krishna consciousness. So this is a very interesting statement by Srila Prabhupada, because generally we preach against social welfare work. Now, what I've come to understand after a long time is that we're not really preaching against social welfare work at all. There's nothing in the scriptures that should predispose us to preach against social welfare work. We're just saying it's not enough. We're not suggesting that there's a society where there's no hospitals. I mean, we don't say in a perfect Krishna conscious society there's no schools, there's no hospitals, there's no money given to poor people. And if we had a Krishna-conscious ruler of the society, that would be part of his duty, to make sure there's clean water. Just like, when you're running the loft here, you've got to make sure that people get proper clothing and proper water. And you can't say, well, no, that's not Krishna-consciousness. But that point is that that's not enough. That in and of itself is not spiritual. Many people think that kind of thing is spiritual. That if I open a hospital, that's spiritual. No, it's not. And so generally, Prabhupada was speaking to people who think that kind of thing is spiritual. All my spiritual service to God is opening hospitals, opening schools, and feeding the poor. Saying, no, that's material. That may be part of your service, but that's not ultimately devotional service in and of itself. But here Prabhupada's saying that that kind of activity will purify people so that they can understand Krishna consciousness. What does that mean? It helps bring people to the mode of goodness where they have the clarity of thought to understand Krishna. And also, Prabhupada gives two reasons why giving charity should be encouraged. One is that it brings people to the mode of goodness so that they have enough clarity of mind, clarity of thought, clarity of heart to understand Krishna. And the other reason, he says, is that if they're sacrificing for something, he says, if one decides to sacrifice for the supreme cause, even if he does not know that the supreme cause is Krishna, he will come gradually to understand that Krishna is the supreme cause by the sacrificial method. So if I say, I want to give my money, my time, my energy to something beyond myself, to something that's really worthy and really meaningful, even if I don't know what's the most worthy and meaningful thing to give to, if I have that mentality, eventually, by sacrificing, I'll come to understand the most worthy place to give to is God. So in those two ways, charity will purify one. But even better is to cultivate. Now, cultivate knowledge again means to understand that the material life doesn't have any enjoyment, that I'm something higher, that I'm a soul, that there's something beyond this body, there's something beyond just making money and having a family and having a house and having a car and whatever. That's what we mean by cultivation of knowledge. So these things, we can certainly, if people say, no, I don't want to take up Krishna consciousness, I don't want to do anything, we can certainly suggest, well, then you can do these things. At least give up some of your hard-earned wealth. At least engage in, study philosophy. Meditate. These things will help you. So this is certainly Krishna's recommendation. Okay. So just to go through this again, just a brief summary. And I'm doing much better with my time today. Of course, it helps that there are only 12 verses. That first, Arjuna is saying, what's better, personalism or impersonalism? And Krishna is saying, go for the personalism. The impersonalism will work, maybe, hopefully, after a lot of trouble and a very, very long time, if you do it right, which is very difficult. Mm-hmm. And Prabhupada says, therefore, we as devotees should never recommend it to anybody. Although, if somebody has taken up impersonalism before meeting the devotees, that may be helpful to them in some context. It may also hurt them in some context. It can go either way. It may make them predisposed to spiritual life, but it may make them opposed to the idea of a personal relationship with Krishna. And personalism, on the other hand, is very easy, and the main reason it's very easy is that Krishna helps you and Krishna takes care of you. I'm just thinking, sometimes you see somebody trying to do something that's very, very difficult, and you offer to help, and they say, no, I want to do it myself. And so you stand back and say, okay, do it yourself. So the impersonalistic path is a person saying, I'm going to do it myself. And Krishna says, okay, do it yourself. Of course, Krishna is always helping. But for the devotee is always thinking of Krishna and depending on him, so Krishna helps them. Krishna's given, we've read so many verses like this, how Krishna's giving you guidance from within. Krishna's even arranging our lives so that we can come to him. And how do we do it? We just naturally think of him in love. Can't do that? Practice thinking of him in love. Can't do that? At least use your body in Krishna's service. Can't do any of those things? Well, at least sacrifice something. Or study philosophy, or do some kind of meditation. Hopefully, after some time, maybe in more than one lifetime, hopefully after some time, then you'll be able to start taking up the real process of bhakti yoga. But at least you'll get started. At least you won't just be becoming degraded. Okay, questions, comments? Yes?
What if we can notice those impersonal tendencies in ourselves and how we relate to others?
Okay. Yes?
Tendency to shy away from real relationships.
From real relationships. Why are we shying away from real relationships? Inconvenience
hurts.
It does hurt, doesn't it? Our relationships, when we're materially conditioned, are definitely going to bring us pain, even if they're with other materially conditioned spiritual practitioners. And sometimes, many times, devotees think, well, as long as I have my relationships with other devotees, that won't happen. It's just not true. If you're still materially conditioned and the other person's still materially conditioned, then more or less you're going to have those same problems. So material relationships are based on a feeling of lack, of incompleteness. I feel I need something. I lack something. It's almost like a hunger, one could say. And I'm thinking that some other living being is going to satisfy my hunger. Generally speaking, I'm sure it doesn't apply to those of you in this room in this situation, but generally speaking, if you ask people why they wanted to get married, they talk about themselves and what they need and how they hope the other person will meet their needs. I've very rarely found the case of the opposite, even among devotees. They talk about what the other person can do for me. And they're looking at the other, when they're evaluating whether or not they want to marry someone, they're evaluating what that person can do for them. What they want. How that person will satisfy their mind and their senses. It's very unusual for a woman to say, I really want to marry this man because I admire him so much and I want to help him in his mission. I just haven't heard something like that. I just feel like I want to serve him. I want to assist him. I'm so inspired by him, sometimes. You know, and the men just saying, oh, this woman, I just want to take care of her and protect her and nourish her and cherish her and really help her achieve Krishna consciousness, sometimes. You hear those sort of things more when people aren't admitting that they're romantically interested. When they're saying, oh, I don't really have a romantic relationship with this person. You hear it more from people like that. You know, you'll see some man and woman in the Hare Krishna movement hanging out together a lot. And you'll say to the woman, why are you doing this? Oh, I'm just so inspired by him. I just want to serve him. And the man will say, oh, I just want to help this girl in Krishna consciousness. And you'll hear it then. But my point is, we're usually thinking of, you know, how can somebody satisfy me? And we're thinking about this in terms of our friends. You know, it's a hard thing to admit, but that's basically where we're coming from. And therefore, if the other person fails to satisfy us, we become angry. We feel frustrated. We feel cheated. I've been cheated. We feel hurt. And then we think, well, I don't want to have any relationships anymore because as soon as I do, I get hurt. What does this hurt mean? I have expectations that you're going to do something for me, and when you don't, I feel hurt. That you're going to be the person who satisfies me, whatever the relationship is, whether this person is your parent or this person is your child or this person is your friend or this person is your husband. And then we don't, you know, We're trying to get something, and therefore we also give. We open ourselves up. We start revealing ourselves. But we're doing that not really to give. We're really doing it to get. And when we don't quite get what we want, we feel hurt. And why don't we get what we want? For two reasons. First of all, the other jiva isn't capable of giving us what we want. They don't have it. It's kind of like, you know, if you're out collecting donations and you go to someone you think is wealthy and it turns out they're not. They don't have it to give. You know, you're out distributing books and you just spent 20 minutes with somebody and it turns out that they don't even have, you know, their pockets are empty. Or their interest is empty. You ever waste all your time with someone whose interest is empty? Their pocket full of interest is empty? All they wanted to do was convince you to surrender to Jesus or something like that, and they had no real interest in taking a book, and you just spent 20 minutes with them, you know? So another jiva, they don't have the capability. We're looking for unlimited satisfaction. We're looking for God. And no jiva is God. It is not. Even a perfected jiva is not God. You see, this happens with disciples and gurus also. I see two reasons people lose faith in their guru or lose enthusiasm to serve their guru. One is if the guru is actually not what you thought he was. But the main reason is that you expect him to be God. You think, you know, my guru is omniscient. and omnipotent, and, you know, he knows everything that's going on in my heart, and he's going to meet all of my needs. But he's a jiva. He can't. He doesn't have that. It's not in his pockets. He can connect you with Krishna, who will meet all your needs. Prabhupada said, if someone says, I'm the best friend, then they're cheating. Prabhupada talks about this to politicians who say, I'm the best friend. So if you think that some jiva is your best friend, uh-uh. They're your best friend if they give you Krishna, but not if you try to enjoy them directly. Just like with the demigods. You can worship the demigods as your guru. Lord Brahma is our parama, 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 parama guru. So many cases in the Bhagavatam where Shiva is guru. What's the problem if you worship them independently? You can do the same thing with guru. You can just think, you know, my guru is going to satisfy you. My husband's going to satisfy me. I'm going to have the perfect Krishna conscious child that's going to satisfy me. Sorry. No, it's not there. So that's the first reason. And then the second reason is, if that other jiva is a conditioned soul, then guess what? They're trying to do the same thing with you. They're trying to get you to meet their hunger. And therefore, you're going to rightly feel that sometimes you're being exploited, because you are. But guess what? You're also trying to exploit. It's kind of like when you're a criminal, one of the punishments is you have to be in jail with, guess who? Other criminals. So it's a problem. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said it's a society of cheaters and cheated. That refers to us also. I'm saying I'm your friend, but I'm thinking, how can I use you? And you're saying I'm your friend, but you're thinking, how can I use you? Again, we don't want to admit these sort of things, but as you go on chanting, you'll see that this is a fact. Therefore, Prabhupada says, in this world there's no love, it's all lust. What does lust mean? Lust means I want to drink you to satisfy my thirst. Love is giving. And even my giving, it's a business deal. And you see this in families all the time. Look, I wash the dishes, I change the nappies, I've been taking care. Now you do something. I just worked hard all day, you do something. What are you doing around here? I'm giving, 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 giving. What are you doing? It's practically universal. This is what you should be doing. It says in the Shastra, these are your duties as a wife. Why aren't you doing them? So honestly, that's not love. That's business. You have a contract. Right? There's a business contract, and this is what I'm giving, and this is what you're giving. So for those two reasons, we feel afraid to have relationships, because the relationships with people are a source of pain and disappointment. The people either aren't capable. You know, when I find out a person's not capable, I think, well, I'll just find another person. They'll be capable. This guy wasn't capable. Well, that guy, he looks capable. He can satisfy all my needs. He's also a jiva. Maybe he'll satisfy some needs that the first jiva didn't, but he won't satisfy other ones. And because we also have this exploitive mentality. And even if I'm dealing with someone who doesn't have an exploitive mentality, as long as I have an exploitive mentality, I'm not going to feel satisfied. I'm going to feel cheated. So then what do? So we say, okay, I won't have any more relationships. I'll just harden my heart. I won't care anymore. Like that famous song of Simon Garfunkel, I'm a rock, I'm an island. You guys too young for that to know that? You know, I've been hurt by relationships, so I'm just going to be a rock, and I won't... A rock feels no pain, an island never cries. So I'll just become hard-hearted. And that's a lot of the problem with the impersonalists. Desires are bad. You know, funny thing, Krishna said here the purpose of Abhyas Yoga was to develop desire. So the impersonalists say desires are bad, relationships are bad, stop desire, stop relationship, just do austerity like that Mahavir, you know, just heavy austerity, 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 and your heart becomes harder and harder and harder. But guess what a hard heart is? Painful. It's really painful. It's like putting on some armor that has spikes on the inside. So yeah, you're protected, but you're being pierced. There's one person in the general community of devotees here who's very angry. And I don't like to deal with this person because this person's very angry. So their anger, yes, it keeps other people from dealing with them. That's true, but it keeps other people from dealing with them. They don't have any nice relationships either. So that doesn't work, and therefore we go back and forth. It's called bhogatyaga. We go back and forth. We try to enjoy, we get hurt, we try to renounce. It's painful. We try to enjoy, it's painful. We try to renounce, it's painful. We try to enjoy, it's painful. We try to renounce, it's painful. We're like, what do I do? I can't enjoy and I can't renounce. So what's the solution? You know what the solution is. The solution is to develop a loving relationship with Krishna. That's the solution. If I develop a loving relationship with Krishna, first of all, he can satisfy me. He's so great that he can satisfy an unlimited number of living beings. I can't satisfy one living being. And he can satisfy an unlimited number of living beings simultaneously and all perfectly. Each cowherd boy, each gopi is totally satisfied. Now, each of the older gopis in Vrindavan wanted to have Krishna as their son. So Krishna became the son of each one of them. He became the child of each of the cows. I can't remember all the names of people I meet. Krishna knows the names of everybody. He calls the names of every single cow. So Krishna has that capacity. He can give unlimitedly. And even when he gives unlimitedly, he's still full. He doesn't become depleted. If I even try to give unlimitedly to you, I become depleted. If I try to just give, after a while, I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Let me go in my room and close the door. People stay away from me for a while. Oh, but Krishna doesn't become depleted. And if I have a loving, if I love Krishna, then I give up this exploitive mentality. Real love for Krishna, as described in the Shikshastika, is I just give and I'm not looking for any return. Now again, when we hear this, we become very frightened because we think materially, if I give without wanting any return, I become depleted, I become cheated, and I'm miserable. And you can't imitate that. I can't imitate just give. I'm just going to give to Gitavali and I'm not going to care if she ever gives me any return. I won't be able to maintain it. And women are especially guilty of this kind of thing. Being in a relationship and just giving, never thinking about themselves. And eventually it blows up and they start thinking about themselves only. But I've seen men do this too. In fact, I was counseling one man who did this. You know, he's married for 10 years and just giving, never thinking about himself. And one day it exploded. And he said, "What about me? I'm not satisfied in this relationship. I think I need somebody else." So you can't imitate that. But when we're filled up with Krishna, the idea is we come to the point where we can just give. But we don't care. We're so happy seeing Krishna happy. We have a little idea of that in this world, that I can be happy by the happiness of somebody else, that I can see my friend happy and feel happy without being happy directly, vicarious happiness. So when I get to that point, then I can truly love all living entities. All right. Now, as part of my falling in love with Krishna, I have to try to be kind to all living entities. But I should do that as part of my loving Krishna and not separately. And then my pain I experience will be minimal. It won't be gone, because until we're actually at that point, we're going to have some pain. Sorry. But it will be greatly reduced. If I love you as a friend, because that will make Krishna happy. If my loving you as a friend, or my loving someone as their wife, or my loving someone as their parent, or my loving someone in whatever capacity, if that's done as part of establishing my relationship with Krishna, then I'm getting my satisfaction from Krishna, not directly from that relationship. I'm trying to make my husband happy, not because I believe I have the capacity to make my husband happy, because I don't. I'm a little jiva. I cannot make my husband happy. Sometimes he'll be happy, and sometimes he won't. But Krishna can always be happy with my attempt. Krishna, I'm doing this to please you. I'm washing his socks to please you. I know he likes puris, so I'm making him puris because I know that if I serve this devotee of yours, you'll be happy with me. And that way, if he comes and says, why did you make puris? I didn't want puris tonight. You'll think, Krishna, you know I did this for you. And there may still be some sting, but not as much. And if someone says, you know, I really don't want to hang out with you today, you think, I'm in this relationship to please Krishna, to try to give to this living being to please Krishna. Not that I think I'm going to have a perfect relationship with any other jiva in a conditioned state. And if you think I'm only going to serve Krishna, not the devotees, that's kanistha adhikari. You can't do that. But it has to be part of your serving Krishna. Don't do it separately. And when you see these things happening because of the material nature, when you see this feeling of, oh, I didn't get what I wanted, then become a little philosophical. Say, it's not possible. It's not the fault of this jiva that they can't satisfy me. It's the fault of it's my fault for looking for satisfaction from a jiva. Okay, I wasn't looking for satisfaction with Krishna. Krishna! Krishna! I want this. I'm not getting it. Can I get it from you, please? Then it'll be very nice. Then that will be very nice. Janaka janani daita tanai prabhu guru pati tuhu sarvamoy. You are my mother. You are my father. You are my lover. You are my son. You are my guru. You are my husband. Sarvamoy, you are everything. So when I'm disappointed in my relationships with my friends or my husband or my child or even my guru, I go to Krishna. Krishna, you're everything. You're everything. What I'm looking for in you. You be everything to me. And let me have relationships with everything to please you and in relationship with you. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I'm taking care of my family because I'm seeing that they're all your servants and maidservants. And therefore, I'm maintaining them to make you happy. And therefore, you see, in the spiritual world, people have so many friends. People have their brothers and sisters and their friends and their parents and their children. And all in relationship to Krishna. So we can gradually develop that. And as we're developing it, be tolerant of the fact that we haven't fully developed it yet. Is that all right? Well, again, what's the anger coming from? Anger is coming, and we'll discuss this in Nectar of Instruction also. Anger is coming at frustration that I didn't get my desire satisfied. Why didn't I get my desire satisfied? Because I had the wrong object for my desires. And because I have an exploitive mood. Those are the two problems. I have the wrong object, and my mood is wrong. It's not the fault of the object. If I'm trying to get the book to play music and it won't do it and I become angry, sometimes you try to get a computer program to do something it's not designed to do. You ever do that? I got this new design program and I was trying to make it do something and the programmer didn't put that feature in the program. Just couldn't do it. So why are we angry at our past relationships? Because our past relationships, I was expecting something unreasonable. And my mentality was exploited. And anger also comes from fear. Anger and fear are very connected. I'm afraid of being hurt. And I use anger as an armor. If I'm angry enough, I won't get hurt again. that my anger will protect me. We very much take shelter of anger. Krishna talks about in the 16th chapter taking shelter of lust, that the demons take shelter of lust. And anger is called the younger brother of lust. But definitely we use anger as armor. I've been hurt. If I'm angry enough, people will not dare to hurt me. They'll be afraid to hurt me. We had one kid in our school who was a bully. And when I was talking to him once, he said, I try to hurt others before they'll hurt me. So just like there is a person in this community who's very angry. And it's a fact. I really try not to get him upset. I try not to hurt him because it's scary. He's a scary person. But I'm not going to be friends with him either. That's for sure. I wouldn't want to work on any projects with him. I wouldn't want to do anything with him. I don't particularly even like to be in the same room with him. I'm happy he's chanting Hare Krishna, but I don't want anything to do with this person. So if you're using anger as your shield, then it's keeping away what you want to. It's hurting you. How can you give up anger? You have to give up fear. You can't give up anger without giving up fear. How do you give up fear? The opposite of fear is peace. Bhaktiram yagatapasam sarvalokam maheshram suvidam sarvabhutanam gyatmam shanti machiti. How do you find peace? Again, it's from a relationship with Krishna. Krishna is controlling everything and he's my best friend. That means no one can hurt me in any way that Krishna hasn't sanctioned. And Krishna is my best friend. So if Krishna is allowing me to be hurt in some way, it must be out of love. If you go to the hospital and you have a tumor, the doctor will cut it out. He'll use a knife. That hurts. Even if they give you anesthesia during the operation, when you come out of the anesthesia, it will be painful. Why is a doctor using a knife? So why does Krishna sometimes use a knife? Doesn't mean he doesn't love us. So I trust that Krishna is taking care of my life. And therefore the pain in my life is also engineered by him. It's my fault. You know, you don't use a knife on a healthy person. I'm the one who got sick, intentionally. You know, if you go to your medicine cabinet here and swallow a bottle full of pills, and then you go to the hospital and they make you throw up. So throwing up is unpleasant. But it's your fault for taking the bottle of pills. So why are you suffering? You're suffering because you took the bottle of pills, and you're suffering because the doctor is making you throw up. So is your suffering coming from you or from the doctor? Both. If you're already fully Krishna conscious, there's no suffering. Even apparent suffering is not suffering. It's just fun. It's just an adventure. You know, the apparent suffering of the Pandavas or whatever. The cowherd boys in Agasura's mouth. They're just having fun. It's a story. So in one sense, when I'm suffering, I'm not really suffering because I'm not the body and mind. In one sense, my suffering isn't actually happening to me at all. It's a movie I'm watching and identifying with. So I'm not really suffering at all. But as long as I identify with it, I certainly feel that it's suffering. But I chose to do something that was harmful for me. And therefore, Krishna, as the doctor, sometimes the treatment is also painful. That's 100% my responsibility, that it's painful. But the treatment is being administered with love. So what is there to be afraid of? First of all, nobody can hurt me. Ever. I'm a soul. Who can hurt me? I can't be hurt by anything. I mean, that's nice to say. Of course, if your arm is bleeding, you feel like it hurts you. And all apparent hurt, which is sometimes very difficult, is part of Krishna's purification. So why should I be afraid? So that takes some time. Takes some time. Try having that mentality a little bit. And also, you see, you can't protect yourself by your fear and anger. Try it. Doesn't work. Does it work? Does being angry and fearful keep you from getting hurt? No. In fact, when you're angry and fearful, you probably get hurt more because people won't like you. You'll have a very hard time having any kind of loving relationships when you're angry and fearful. Plus, you'll be hurting yourself and poisoning, literally poisoning yourself. Anger literally puts poison into your body. So, you know, does it work? Does my anger and fear work? No. Bad things are going to happen anyway. One devotee explained this to me in a very interesting way. This devotee was saying, we start out really being angry at Krishna. We start out with a feeling of envy and anger at Krishna. Why are you in charge and I'm not? That's how we start out. Then we engage in materialistic activities which cause us to suffer. When we suffer, we feel justified at being angry at Krishna. The Krishna is fulfilling our desires. You want to feel angry at me? Like somebody's parents say, stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about. So Krishna is saying, you want to be angry at me? Fine. Now you have a reason to be angry. That we intentionally commit sins for which we'll suffer, and then we can say it's God's fault. Our anger at other living entities is also ultimately anger at Krishna. And at ourselves. It's really who we're angry at. Really, we're not angry at, you know, Krishna Das or Krishna Dasi. Really. Really not angry at them. We're really angry at Krishna. And when you see that, you see where you're going, that's the root of our material life. And we're afraid. We don't trust him. We don't think that he's really benevolent. We think we know better than him. This takes time. It takes time and it takes practice. It's not something you can just will yourself into doing in a minute or two. It takes practice. And as you practice, Krishna will help you. As you practice trusting him, okay, Krishna, I trust you. If you're allowing this person to say these things or do these things that are hurtful to me, if you're allowing, you know, me to get my head broken in a car crash, if you're allowing whatever... You lose all my money if you're allowing. I said that once in a class, and when I went back to my room, my wallet had been stolen. That was interesting. So, okay, Krishna, all right. You want me to practice what I preach? Huh? It was at a Sunday feast, and I hadn't locked my door. So when you see these things and say, you know, okay, Krishna, ultimately you're doing this, and you're all good. You're doing this for some reason. Show me the reason. But not like, show me the reason. That doesn't work. He's not interested in that. But if you come to him as a willing student and say, okay, Lord, all right, what's the lesson here? I'm ready. All right. Show me what you want me to learn. He will. You may be surprised at what it is. It may not be something you want to see. And then gradually you give up your fear. And as you give up your fear, you give up your anger. Giving up your fear and anger doesn't mean that you become a wishy-washy, wimpy person that anybody can kick around. Your body is also Krishna's property. Your mind is also Krishna's property. But your whole mood will be very different. We don't see the devotees are wimps. Sometimes. Like Maharaj Ambarish didn't fight back when Durvasa Muni came. You know that story? Durvasa Muni was offended at nothing. He had created the situation, in fact. And he was going to kill. Maharaj Amrish was going to kill the king. Created a demon. His anger turned into a demon to attack the king. And the king just stood there, just folded his hands and just stood there. He didn't retaliate. We should notice, though, he was a king. Now, if he were on the battlefield and another king challenged him, he would certainly retaliate. He would certainly fight. He wouldn't just stand there with folded hands. Why was he standing there with folded hands? Durvasa Muni was a brahmana and his guest. And Maharaj Ambarish considered that he had offended him by drinking water. So Ambarish's mood was, I did offend my guest. I didn't want to, but I felt obligated to offend my guest. I did offend my guest. He's a brahmana. I don't fight with brahmanas. And he's my guest. I have to treat my guests like God. So he wants to kill me, fine, he can kill me. But it wasn't that that was his mood in general. His mood in general was not anybody wants to kill me, they can just kill me. At all. He was king. Now, of course, Krishna protected him. Or Haridas Thakur, you know, when he was being beaten. But what was he supposed to do? And how was he supposed to retaliate? He had no means to. They're the government. You know, if the government ties you up in chains and starts beating you, like happened with some of our devotees in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, what are you supposed to do? You don't really have very many options. Or Prahlad Maharaj, you know, if your father's running the universe, you can't go complain to the police force or social services, you know. Where are you going to go? You just say, okay, Krishna, whatever you want to do. Krishna, you want to kill me? Krishna, you want to save me? Marobi rakobi yoi chetohar. Nice song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. You want to save me, you want to protect me. It's your business. You want to let somebody hurt me? That's your business. At the same time, if you know that so-and-so, you know that Krishna Dasi goes around yelling at everybody and is really mean, you know, just stay away from her, respect her from a distance. If you have to work with Krishna Dasi, you don't have any option. You're put in the same car going somewhere and you're not going to jump out the window into the motorway. Then you say, okay, Krishna, you put me in the situation with this person who's yelling at me. I surrender to you. You must want me to learn something from it. Okay? It doesn't mean you have to be a wimp. You can say, I really don't want to work with this person. And if your authority say, too bad, you're working with this person, then okay, Krishna, hey. Hey, Krishna. All right. What do you want me to learn? All right? You don't, like, walk in front of cars. You don't close your eyes and walk in front of cars and, okay, Krishna, if you arrange I get hit by a car, that's your mercy. That's dumb. You don't drive blindfolded. I'm just depending on you, Krishna. Whatever happens is your will. That's not your role as a servant. You know, but if you're doing your best to drive and a big lorry smashes into your will, you know, what are you going to do? Angry? Or are you going to say, okay, Krishna, everything you do is good. Okay? So use your discrimination, use your judgment, who you associate with, who you make good friends with, to the best of your ability. Don't. I mean, you should avoid people who are disturbing. You should. You're supposed to. That's your duty. If you can. But sometimes you can't. Right? What to do? And one last thing I should say is to remember that we also disturb others. Have some humility. And you may not even be aware of it. There may be something you said 2 years ago, and there's somebody right now walking around on this planet who's in great pain because of something you said 2 years ago. And you don't even remember what you said. And it didn't mean anything to you. And they're in agony. Or you were upset one day, or whatever, you know, and you said something that you knew was a little nasty, but you just said it anyway, or did it anyway. And maybe there's somebody walking around who's in a lot of pain from that. So we do it too. You know, we hurt people too. So a little humility is good. You know, what right do I have to be so angry at other people? I'm an exploitive person too, and I hurt people too, and people are fried with me. And You know, there are people right now somewhere on this planet suffering because of something that I've done in my life or said or whatever. And there are. Anybody here say that you've never done anything to cause another living entity pain? And sometimes it was even knowingly. Sometimes it was unknowingly. I put it in three categories. One is I hurt another living entity completely unknowingly. I'm just no awareness at all. I'm just doing what I'm doing and somebody feels hurt by what I've done. And I don't even know they feel hurt. I had no intention to hurt them. Other category is I know I'm hurting somebody, but I feel that the thing that I'm trying to accomplish is so important that I don't really care. Or I care, but I think I can't avoid it. And that may be either I'm in a lot of pain and I'm trying to get something for myself and I know I'm saying or doing something that hurts others, but I think my own needs are too important. Or the work I'm doing is so important that if I offend somebody or whatever, what can be done? So I know I'm hurting someone, I know I'm offending someone, but I think the need is greater than the hurt I'm giving. And the last category, which we don't do that often, but we do it, is where I intentionally hurt somebody. And this generally happens if someone has hurt me and I feel that I want to hurt them back. And I will say something or do something that I know very well is going to upset that person. Well, you never did that. And I know that they're going to feel bad when I say it, and I still say it. And in fact, my intention is to cause harm. Now, often, I think that there's some higher purpose. I think that if I say such nasty things and do such nasty things, it will help our relationship or whatever. But, you know, I usually cover it with something. I don't usually get up and say, I'm an evil person who's going to do harm. I mean, some people generally don't. But I may think, in order to accomplish this, I have to hurt you. So the second was, in order to accomplish this, you may have to get hurt, and I wish you didn't have to get hurt, and I wish you didn't have to be like that, but what can I do? I can't do anything about it, which isn't always true. And the other one is, I want to accomplish something, and to accomplish that, I must hurt you, and I want to hurt you in order to accomplish this. So if we're guilty of those three things, then how much can I be angry at somebody else that they're guilty of it? Like Jesus said, you know, you see a speck in someone else's eye, and you want to take the speck out of someone else's eye. He said, you hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye. So then you'll be able to see better to take the speck out of your brother's eye. So, you know, stop, introspect, pray. Krishna, have I hurt anybody? Is there anyone I need to apologize to? How can I get my own house in order? Is that all right? Okay. So we looked at, again, should it be personalism or impersonalism? Impersonalism is hard, may not get you to the goal. Personalism is easy because Krishna helps you. And personalism is you love Krishna naturally all the time. You can't do that. You practice loving Krishna. And if you can't do that, at least do some work for Krishna. If you don't think you can do any of that, then at least do some karma gyan or yoga in accord with the shastra. And hopefully someday you'll become purified. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.